September 12, 1943, Los Angeles, California. 29-year-old actor David Bacon tells his wife he is planning to go swimming and leaves their home. Later that afternoon, Bacon's car is seen driving erratically before it jumps a curb and crashes into a bean field. After Bacon stumbles out of the car and dies, a fatal knife wound is discovered in his back. The investigation uncovers numerous secrets in Bacon's life, including a coded diary and a rented apartment, but no answers about who actually murdered him. After that, the trail went cold.
Meigs!
Meigs can't hear you, Sakima.
The Masked Marvel. You are too clever to be working for a stupid democracy. Perhaps you would consider...
You talk like your ambassador did just before Pearl Harbor. You're finished, Sakima. Your organization is smashed. This is the last act of your little drama.
You expect to take me alive?
Alive or dead, you're coming with me. I have the advantage of a gun.
That is no advantage in the dark.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our official one-year anniversary episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and I can hardly believe that it's already been a year since I started this podcast. And I'd say things have gone pretty well. During this time, I've built up an incredible fan base of wonderfully supportive listeners who have made this podcast more successful than I ever could have envisioned. So I thought I would show my appreciation by putting up a poll on our Facebook page and letting you folks vote on which case should be featured on our anniversary episode. The cases were selected from one of the most popular articles I wrote for listverse.com, 10 Entertainment Careers Cut Short by Unsolved Mysteries, which was originally published in May of 2013. To my surprise, the overwhelming winner with 48% of the vote was the 1943 murder of an actor named David Bacon. I only say it's surprising because this is not a particularly well-known Hollywood mystery, but one of our podcast's best traits is that we tackle cases which people aren't always familiar with. Right before his death, David Bacon had played the title character in a film serial called The Masked Marvel, which is the source of that ultra-cheesy soundbite you just heard. Since I've actually got quite a fondness for cheesy serials from the 1940s, I was tickled to have the opportunity to cover this story. I also need to deliver a shout-out to the website LADailyMirror.com, a blog where Los Angeles Times copy editor Larry Harnish looks back at the history of the city. It includes an extensive article about the David Bacon murder, which, in the style of a 1940s serial, is broken up into 12 separate chapters. This website was invaluable in my research because it debunks a lot of misinformation about the case which is out there, particularly on David Bacon's Wikipedia page. But I'll go into more detail about that a little later. Before we get started, just a brief reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which alternates between our regular full-length episodes and 15 to 20-minute minisodes. We deliver either a new full-length episode or a new minisode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who's feeling generous and wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it and we'll be sure to give you a shout out on a future episode. We also have a pair of new donors this week named Stacy and Fred, so thank you very much, guys. And I also have to deliver a special thanks to one of our listeners, Esther Gomez, a very talented artist who did the cover art for this episode. A few weeks ago, Esther decided to send us some artwork she'd done depicting some famous unsolved mysteries, including the Black Dahlia and Bella in the Wick Elm, and we were so impressed that we asked if she would be interested in doing some artwork for our one-year anniversary episode. And she wound up delivering us an amazing drawing featuring the Masked Marvel, which you can see on our website. So, thank you very much, Esther. We're also providing a link to her Tumblr page, so you can check out the other amazing artwork she's done. So with all that out of the way, let us now start examining the mystery which garnered the majority of your votes, the murder of David Bacon. Our story begins in Los Angeles in 1943. Our central figure is David Bacon, a 29-year-old actor who originally hails from Barnstable, Massachusetts. He was born under the name Gaspar Griswold Bacon Jr. to a very prominent wealthy family. His father, Gaspar Griswold Bacon Sr., was president of the Massachusetts Senate and served as the state's lieutenant governor for 2 years during the 1930s. The younger Bacon graduated from Harvard, but decided he wanted to pursue a career in acting. He eventually moved to Los Angeles and changed his first name to David, probably because no one was going to achieve stardom in Hollywood with a name like Gaspar. Bacon really didn't have much success in the field until 1942, when he started getting supporting roles in a handful of movies. 1 year later, he received his biggest break when he was cast to play the title character in the film serial, The Masked Marvel. Now, if you're not familiar with how serials worked, they were extremely popular between the 1930s and 1950s. They usually feature a story which would be divided up into about a dozen or so chapters that were around 20 to 30 minutes long. Whenever you went to see a movie in a theater, a chapter would play before the main feature, and they'd all end on a cliffhanger in order to compel you to return to the cinema the following week to see what happened next. These serials did not have the highest budget or the greatest production values, and pretty much went by the wayside when television was invented. But watching them today provides a fun glimpse into the past. Anyway, The Masked Marvel told the story of a masked vigilante hero who took on an espionage organization run by an evil Japanese saboteur, because as you can tell by the none-too-subtle Pearl Harbor reference in that clip, this serial was produced during World War II when Japan was the enemy. What's funny here is that even though David Bacon played the title character, the audience didn't actually know this until the very end. The story had a gimmick where there were four main characters, one of whom was played by Bacon, and kept it a mystery which of these characters was secretly the Masked Marvel. When I say Bacon portrayed the title character, that statement is kind of a stretch, because a masked stuntman actually performed most of the Masked Marvel's action scenes throughout the serial, until Bacon was shown taking off his mask at the very end. Now, the main reason I'm going into detail about all this stuff is because of the strange circumstances of how Bacon got the role. Believe it or not, four different actors, yes, that's right, four, were cast to play Bacon's character before him, but they all wound up getting injured. Quite frankly, it sounds like The Masked Marvel was a cursed production, and there are a number of bizarre coincidences surrounding it. There was actually another actor in the cast named Rod Bacon, who was of no relation to David, but he died in 1948 at the age of 33, though I've been unable to uncover any details about what actually happened to him. David Bacon managed to make it through the production without getting injured, but he apparently joked, "I'll probably get hurt going home in the car." And, well, what I'm about to tell you next occurred only 2 weeks later. On September 12, 1943, Bacon was living in a lavish house in the Hollywood Hills region of Los Angeles with his 40-year-old wife, Greta Keller. Keller was a famous cabaret singer from Austria before she moved to the United States during the 1930s. She had one previous marriage under her belt before she hooked up with David Bacon. David and Greta had been married just under a year at this point, and Greta is 5 months pregnant. David's acting career seemed to be going well, as 2 days earlier, he had signed to play the lead role in a movie called Phantom Lady. On this particular day, David wanted to go swimming, and Greta was initially planning to go with him, until she spoke with her physician, who advised against it because of her pregnancy. David apparently told Greta that he didn't want to go swimming without her, but they got into an argument because he wanted to have sex, and she wasn't in the mood. Greta then took a nap sometime between noon and 2 p.m., When she woke up, she discovered that David had left the house in her car without telling her. Curiously, even though David usually took his three dogs with him whenever he went swimming, they were left behind. The couple's favorite swimming spot was a beach house in Santa Monica which belonged to a friend of theirs, but it would turn out that David never visited there that afternoon. At around 5 p.m., witnesses would see Greta's car driving erratically along Washington Boulevard in a rural area just outside Los Angeles. It wound up swerving across the road, jumping a curb, and crashing into a bean field. When witnesses ran to the scene to help, they saw David Bacon stumbling out of the car, wearing nothing but a pair of blue denim shorts. He fell to the ground, and it turned out he had a stab wound on the left side of his back. According to one of the witnesses, Bacon whispered the words, "Please help me," before he died. The police were then called in to investigate the scene. It turned out that Bacon's stab wound was between 5 and 6 inches deep and caused a hemorrhage of his left lung. The probable weapon was a stiletto blade, though it was never found. Bacon was likely stabbed while he was leaning forward, and the coroner determined that he wouldn't have lived more than 20 minutes after receiving the wound. Bacon's shorts were dry, so he had not worn them into the water recently, but there were specks of sand on them to indicate he'd been on a beach. Bacon had his wallet with him with $13 inside, and he was still wearing two valuable rings, so robbery did not seem like a motive for the murder. While examining the vehicle, police found no blood on the exterior, but a great deal of it inside. There was a bathrobe on the back seat which was covered in blood, but since there was no knife mark on it, Bacon had not been wearing it when he was stabbed. The only fingerprints found inside the car belonged to Bacon. The strangest clue was a navy blue sweater which one of the witnesses had taken from the vehicle and placed under Bacon's head. The sweater was two sizes too small for Bacon, and had blonde hairs on it, which were not his since Bacon's hair was brown. It resembled a specific type of sweater which had been given out to athletes at a Venice Beach high school 5 years earlier, but it could never be conclusively matched to anybody. There were also apparently three small feathers on the sweater, which led to speculation that its owner might have been employed at a poultry market or a farm. Well, the area where Bacon was found was in close proximity to Venice Beach, and there were some interesting statements from eyewitnesses on the day of the murder. A woman claimed she'd passed Bacon's car shortly before the crash and thought she saw a dark-haired man in a dark suit sitting next to the driver. But another witness at a gas station about a half mile away claimed he had seen both a man and a woman in the car with Bacon when it drove past the station on two separate occasions that afternoon. The first time, the vehicle was heading in the direction of a beach before it returned about 35 minutes later. When Greta Keller was informed about her husband's death, she collapsed and went into a state of shock. In fact, her reaction caused complications with her pregnancy, and the baby wound up being stillborn. At first, the police theorized that Bacon might have been murdered by a hitchhiker he picked up, as he did have a habit of giving rides to random strangers. But it soon became apparent that something was a little off here. Throughout the course of the investigation, the police would find at least four witnesses who remembered seeing Bacon at Venice Beach at various points, both with and without his dogs. Like I said earlier, whenever David and Greta went swimming together, they'd usually go to a friend's beach house in Santa Monica. But Greta claimed she'd never been to Venice Beach, and that David had never let her go there. It soon became obvious that David had a habit of keeping secrets from his wife when detectives found a diary in his bedroom, which he had written entirely in some sort of secret code. According to Greta, she knew this diary existed, but David never allowed her to read it. She was able to help police decipher some of the coded material inside the diary, which turned out to be the names and phone numbers for a number of their friends and acquaintances. However, there were coded portions of the diary where Greta was unable to provide any assistance. The police actually hired cipher experts to decode certain sections of the diary, but they were unsuccessful and failed to uncover any compelling information which could shed light on his murder. Another bizarre clue was a key found in Bacon's wallet which did not belong to his home. Instead, it was matched to a studio apartment Bacon had rented inside a house in Laurel Canyon. It was located less than 10 minutes away from Bacon's own house, and he had rented it only 12 days before his death. The house was owned by a retired physician named Charles Hendricks, who claimed Bacon told him he was renting it for a friend. Greta was aware David had rented the apartment, as he told her it was for a gardener he was planning to hire to do some work at their house. However, Greta found this a little strange, since they already had a trailer on their property, which would have been adequate living quarters for a gardener. When police searched the apartment, they found a lot of evidence to suggest a female had been living there. Three empty women's purses and the torn sleeve of a woman's blouse were discovered inside a drawer, and several women's cigarette holders were found in the apartment. They also found a towel with the name Buckland on it, and it was eventually traced to a guy named Wilfred Buckland Jr. It turned out that Buckland had left the towel there while helping a friend of his named Harry Frazee move into the apartment. Frazee was a music producer from New York who responded to a rental ad Bacon had placed in the newspaper, which offered use of the apartment in exchange for several hours of gardening work per day. The woman's cigarette holders belonged to a female friend of Frazee, who had also helped him move into the apartment. According to Frazee, he only stayed in the apartment 4 days before he was offered a job elsewhere and decided to move out. Frazee was subsequently cleared as a suspect in Bacon's murder. However, 2 days before the murder, Charles Hendricks claimed he showed up at the apartment to collect some rent money from Bacon and saw him there with an unidentified man who was not Harry Frazee. This man did not say one word to Hendricks, and he appeared to be angry. Well, it turned out this guy was a 20-year-old named Glenn Irwin Shaum, who was tracked down when investigators found his phone number and Bacon's belongings. Shaum had recently deserted from the Navy and also answered Bacon's ad for a gardener. He claimed he only visited Bacon's apartment one time and never actually moved in or took the job, but it seemed likely he was the angry, unidentified man Hendricks saw. However, Shaum was cleared as a suspect because he had an alibi placing him with his wife on the day of the murder. Now, it still appeared that David Bacon was attempting to conceal some secrets, and he did have at least one unsavory incident from his past. In September of 1939, while living in Los Angeles, Bacon was arrested for, and I'm quoting one of the original articles here, contributing to the delinquency of a 15-year-old newsboy. This newsboy had apparently visited Bacon's home to collect some money for newspapers when Bacon answered the door wearing nothing but a pajama top. Bacon invited the newsboy inside and soon made an inappropriate sexual advance towards him. Now, it sounds like the boy left before things crossed the line into sexual assault, but Bacon did get into some legal trouble for this. He seemed pretty regretful about his actions, so Bacon wound up getting a suspended sentence on the condition that he leave the state of California for 3 years. Bacon did just that, though it sounds like he returned to Los Angeles before the 3 years were up, as he received his first film role in 1942. But this incident caused a lot of speculation about why Bacon was so secretive about certain things with his wife, and if he really was renting out this extra apartment for the purposes of hiring a gardener. Anyway, the case got even weirder when a young man named Blakely Patterson came forward and told the Los Angeles Examiner that Bacon was his friend and that he'd received a threatening extortion letter demanding money prior to his death. After Patterson's story made the papers, he was questioned by police, but his story completely fell apart. It turned out this so-called friend had never actually met David Bacon in his life. Patterson was an aspiring actor who thought that if he shared a crazy story which got his picture in the paper, then that might help jumpstart his career. Well, Patterson was charged with preparing false evidence, served 10 days in jail, and received a reduced sentence after promising to leave California and return to his hometown in Minnesota. Another young man named Charles Weil confessed to Bacon's murder, but he also turned out to be nothing more than an attention seeker, and his story was dismissed by police. After a couple months, the crime pretty much disappeared from the spotlight, and Greta Keller eventually returned to Europe to resume her career before her death in 1977. Even with all these intriguing clues to work with, police were unable to find any strong suspects in the murder of David Bacon. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So, before I provide an analysis, I feel like I should address some of the misinformation which has spread about this case. If you've read David Bacon's Wikipedia page, you might have noticed that I've yet to mention some of the juiciest aspects of this mystery. For starters, there's Bacon's alleged connection with one of the most iconic, larger-than-life figures of the 20th century, Howard Hughes. Even though he's best known for his work in aviation, Hughes was also a very prominent movie producer in Hollywood during this time period, and the story goes that he discovered David Bacon. The main source of this is a biography titled Howard Hughes, Hell's Angel, which was written by Darwin Porter in 2005. Porter was good friends with Greta Keller, and claims that shortly before her death, she shared a ton of shocking information with him. Apparently, Hughes was going to give Bacon his big break by casting him as Billy the Kid in his western The Outlaw. Ultimately, Hughes decided that Bacon was not quite right for this role, but signed him to an exclusive contract in 1942. Before long, however, the two men became homosexual lovers. According to Greta, her husband was writing tell-all memoirs about the affair and was going to use them as blackmail material before his untimely death. So she believed that Howard Hughes was responsible for David's murder. Yeah, that story is probably a load of crap. Darwin Porter has probably written more celebrity biographies than anyone, but his books are notorious for being sensationalist and ridiculously inaccurate, and he's been flat-out accused of making stuff up, particularly if his stories involve people who are no longer alive to refute his claims. And that holds true with his biography of Howard Hughes. Not only is there no evidence that Hughes and David Bacon engaged in a homosexual relationship, but they probably didn't even know each other at all. The LA Daily Mirror website does a very good job at poking holes in the story that Hughes discovered Bacon in 1942 and planned to cast him in The Outlaw. For instance, the website posts a couple of newspaper articles from 1940 about the casting and production of The Outlaw. The problem is that Bacon had left the state of California the year before as part of his sentencing for the incident with the newsboy, so he was not anywhere near Hollywood or the film industry in 1940. Therefore, how could Hughes have discovered Bacon and considered him for the lead role in The Outlaw? You might have also noticed that I've yet to mention the most intriguing clue from this case. There are a lot of sources out there which state that a camera was found in Bacon's car, and that when the film was developed, it revealed one photograph of Bacon smiling while he was nude on a beach, which seemed to indicate the photo was taken by his killer shortly before his death. That's pretty creepy, but here's the problem. I could not find one newspaper article from that time period which made any mention of the camera or the photograph. So it's possible this detail might have been completely fabricated, but has been shared so many times over the years that it's now accepted as fact. When I saw that the photo was mentioned in the Hell's Angel biography, alarm bells went off in my head. First off, the description of the murder scenes in the book are full of inaccuracies. It claimed that Bacon's wallet contained $150, but all the news articles clearly state that it was only $13. And Darwin Porter wrote that the photograph and the bloodstained wallet were returned to Greta Keller, who subsequently turned them over to him after her death, and that they're now among his personal possessions. Yeah, that also sounds like a load of crap to me. So unfortunately, it seems likely that the details about Howard Hughes and the mysterious photograph were falsehoods dreamt up by Darwin Porter for his book, which have now spread across the internet and are currently listed on David Bacon's Wikipedia page. Unfortunately, my List First article even mentions these details, but it was published several months before the write-up about the case appeared on the LA Daily Mirror website and denounced the stories from Porter's book. If I'd seen this beforehand, my write-up about David Bacon probably would have been a whole lot different. The biography also shares some other sordid stories about Bacon, like how he was nearly expelled from Harvard because of a homosexual scandal, where he and his roommates were, and I quote, auditioning some of the best bodies on the football team. But that's probably not true either, as the entire section on Bacon is just filled with inaccuracies. For instance, the book claims that Bacon was a member of a summer stock theater group for college undergraduates called the University Players, where he became friends with Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda before they were famous. Except if you do 5 seconds of research, you'll see that Bacon would still have been in high school during the time the University Players were around. The biography also claims that Greta Keller was a lesbian, and that she had affairs with some famous Hollywood actresses, which is also probably untrue. The implication is that David and Greta were hitched together in a lavender marriage. In case you're not familiar with the term, lavender marriages are when someone hooks up with a member of the opposite sex to cover up the fact that they are homosexual or bisexual. Lavender marriages used to be arranged in Hollywood in order to denounce rumors that a prominent star might be gay, the most famous example being when Rock Hudson got married to a woman named Phyllis Gates, because an exposé was about to come out about Hudson's secret homosexual lifestyle. Now, in spite of all the BS that Darwin Porter spewed in his book, I can't completely dismiss the idea that David Bacon and Greta Keller were involved in a lavender marriage. It goes without saying that if you were gay and you wanted to build a successful career in Hollywood during the 1940s, you would have to keep that under wraps. Now, one sordid story about David, which is 100% true, is the inappropriate sexual advance that he made towards the 15-year-old newsboy. There are actual news articles out there which put that incident on the record, so we know it actually happened, and it does seem to show that David did have homosexual tendencies. I have no idea if there's any truth to the allegations that Greta was a lesbian, but she did have one previous marriage under her belt, and her union with David did sound pretty unusual. Greta was 11 years older than David. They got married relatively quickly after they met, and she soon became pregnant for the first time at age 40. She never got remarried after David's death, and didn't seem too fazed by the fact that her husband appeared to be keeping secrets from her. So if this was a lavender marriage born out of convenience, I actually wouldn't be too surprised. But let's get back to the murder itself. Even without the presence of Howard Hughes or the nude photograph of David on the beach, there are still a lot of bizarre elements to this mystery. Even if Bacon wasn't carrying on an affair with Hughes, it still looks like he was leading some sort of double life. You might think the detail about Bacon's secret coded diary sounds like another fabricated story from Darwin Porter's book, but this diary was mentioned in a bunch of the original newspaper articles, so it's 100% real. We definitely know that Bacon was renting out an apartment, and I have my doubts that it was just for the purpose of hiring a gardener. And when Bacon left his home on the afternoon of his death, he likely went to some secret rendezvous that he didn't want his wife to know about. He told Greta that he wasn't sure he wanted to go swimming without her, yet he left the house while she was sleeping without telling her, apparently after they got into a quarrel about her not wanting to have sex with him. He also left the dogs behind, which he usually took with him when he went swimming, and he never showed up at the usual place he went swimming. Instead, he's found near Venice Beach, a location he told his wife he never wanted her visiting. So something was definitely going on with this guy. In the LA Daily Mirror write-up about the case, Larry Harnish brings up a pretty interesting point when discussing the coded diary. One of the articles states that when Greta told the police about the diary, she, and I quote, was never permitted to examine it, but knew that it was kept in the movie actor's bedroom. Interesting that the article didn't say the diary was kept in their bedroom, which seems to give off the impression they were sleeping in separate bedrooms, lending credence to the theory that this was a marriage of convenience for public appearances. Greta seemed pretty nonchalant about the fact that her husband kept his own secret coded diary and wouldn't let her see it, so she might have suspected that her husband had his own needs and liked to partake in homosexual activity. Even after David was murdered, this still wouldn't have been the sort of thing Greta would want to share with the police or the media. Given the time period, that kind of revelation could have effectively ruined her career for good. And then there's the apartment David rented out inside the house at Laurel Canyon. It's pretty incredible that he first rented it out only 12 days before his death, yet an awful lot of activity seemed to take place there during that time. So we have this guy, Harry Frazee, who answers an ad and rents the place in exchange for doing some gardening work for Bacon, yet he moves out only 4 days later because he's supposedly been offered another job. That does sound pretty strange, especially since Frazee just decided to leave some of his friend's personal items behind when he moved out. Now, we know that Frazee and the friends who helped him move into the place were cleared of any involvement in Bacon's murder. But one thing I'm not too sure about is if this guy actually did any gardening work for Bacon during his stay there. It would not surprise me if Bacon placed the ad for a gardener as a means of luring someone to stay at the apartment, and if this evolved into a homosexual relationship, they'd have a convenient hideaway to carry out the affair. If Bacon made unwanted sexual advances towards Frazee, then that might explain why he moved out of the apartment so abruptly. Sure, Frazee never said anything about this to the police, but this was 1943, and most people are not going to want their name associated with a story involving homosexuality, even if they didn't actually do anything. And then there's Glenn Irwin Schaum, the young man who was seen with Bacon inside the apartment 2 days before the murder. And according to Charles Hendricks, Schaum looked pretty agitated. Schaum had a bit of a sketchy background, as he was a Navy deserter, and in fact, right after he was questioned by police, he was turned back over to the Navy to face his desertion charges. What's odd about this situation was that Schaum was married. By comparison, Harry Frazee was in between jobs and shacking up with one of his friends. He did not have a permanent residence at the time, so it wasn't unusual that he would move wherever the work took him. But Chom was living with his wife, so why would he be willing to pack up and move into different living quarters just to work as a gardener? This is what makes me wonder if something else was going on between Bacon and Chom. As far as I can tell, Chom claimed that he answered Bacon's ad on September 10th, which is when Hendrick saw them together in the apartment. After the meeting, Bacon drove Chom back home, and this was the only time they ever met. It's possible that when Chom answered the ad, he learned there was no gardening work, and that Bacon was only interested in sex. If Chom was disgusted by this, it might have been the reason he looked so agitated when Hendrix arrived at the apartment. Or maybe Chom was actually interested in hooking up with Bacon, but decided to back out because someone had seen them together. Maybe this wasn't the only time the two men had gotten together at the apartment, and there was something between them. Again, this was 1943, so it's understandable why Chom wouldn't have mentioned if Bacon made sexual advances towards him. Now, Chom was cleared as a suspect in Bacon's murder, because he had an alibi placing him with his wife that afternoon. I might be skeptical if his wife was the only person providing him with the alibi, but one of the articles stated that witnesses established that Chom spent the entire day with his wife. So if there were independent witnesses placing Chom at another location at the time of the murder, then that would mean he's completely innocent. However, the main reason I wondered about Chom and his wife is because evidence suggests there was a woman involved in this whole thing. For starters, there's the fact that three empty women's purses and the torn sleeve of a woman's blouse were discovered inside a drawer in Bacon's apartment. They also found those woman's cigarette holders and established that they belonged to Harry Frazee's friend, but I don't see any indication that the purses or the torn piece of blouse belonged to her. If they didn't, then I really don't understand what they would be doing there, since I'm not sure Bacon ever met up with any women inside the apartment at any point. But if you're looking for an innocent explanation, I guess it's possible that maybe a previous tenant left them behind, and those purses were there before Bacon even rented the place. After all, if they were inside a drawer, then they easily could have been overlooked for a long time without anybody noticing. But then there's the one witness who claimed they saw both a man and a woman inside Bacon's car with him on separate occasions on the afternoon of the murder. The witness says he saw them driving towards a beach and then returning in the opposite direction 35 minutes later. We have a second witness who claims she saw Bacon in his car with just a male passenger, but it sounds like this took place after the eyewitness sighting of the man and the woman together. Now, as I've stated many times on this podcast, eyewitness testimony is often unreliable, so it's possible that one or both of these witnesses were mistaken about what they saw and didn't actually see Bacon's vehicle. But if the witness at the gas station was accurate, then who was this woman in the car? If you discount all the information in Darwin Porter's book, then there really isn't any information about Bacon's love life before he married Greta Keller. I have no idea if he had many other relationships with women, or if he might have been bisexual. I guess it's possible that he could have been cheating on his wife with both men and women, and that might be the real reason purses were found in his apartment. Maybe the man and the woman seen in the car with him were a swingers couple who decided to bring Bacon in on their action. We do know that no one ever came forward to say they were with Bacon on the afternoon of his murder. I guess it's possible that this couple could have met up with Bacon for a tryst before they went their separate ways, and that the man seen in the car with Bacon later that day was an entirely different person. Remember, Bacon did apparently have a habit of giving rides to strangers, so who says he couldn't have picked up a hitchhiker on the way home? If a couple did meet up with Bacon that day, but had nothing to do with his death, then it's understandable that they never came forward. Because like I said numerous times before, this was 1943, and certain subjects were taboo. But if a man and a woman were involved in Bacon's murder, then that opens up so many possible scenarios. One member of the couple could have killed Bacon because they were angry about him having an affair with their partner. However, this theory would all depend on whether the witness who claimed he saw the couple in the car with Bacon was accurate or not. Whatever the scenario, it's very probable that the murder was a crime of passion. Since Bacon's valuables were left behind, robbery was clearly not the motive. The physical evidence seems to suggest that the killing was related to sexual activity. Bacon was wearing nothing but a pair of shorts when he died, and his bathrobe was found in the back seat. Even though the robe was covered in blood, there was no knife mark, so Bacon was not wearing it when he was stabbed. One thing I've always wondered about is if Bacon wore any other clothing that day. Did he usually only put on shorts and a robe whenever he drove to the beach? I have to wonder if he wore other clothing, such as a shirt, which was never found because he took it off at another location and left it behind when he attempted to drive away. Since there was no blood on the exterior of the vehicle, it seems very likely he was stabbed inside. I am inclined to think that Bacon took off his robe and climbed into the back seat in preparation for sex before he was stabbed in the back, causing him to bleed all over his robe. The assailant probably fled the scene without making sure Bacon was dead, which is why Bacon had enough time to get behind the wheel and drive his vehicle down the road before he ultimately crashed and succumbed to his wound. Since Bacon wouldn't have lived more than 20 minutes after he was stabbed, the actual incident had to have taken place a relatively short distance from where his vehicle was found, but investigators were never able to pin down an exact location. And the other intriguing piece of evidence was the sweater found in Bacon's vehicle, which did not belong to him. The killer may have taken the sweater off for sexual activity, or maybe just to go swimming or something, but either way, they probably left in such a hurry that they forgot about it. The details investigators uncovered about the sweater, how it was given out to athletes at a Venice Beach high school 5 years earlier, they're pretty specific and should have narrowed down the list of potential suspects, which makes it all the more surprising that the sweater couldn't be traced to anyone. However, the sweater strongly suggests that the killer was a resident of Venice. We have numerous sightings placing Bacon in Venice Beach on different days, not just on the day he was killed, and he apparently made those trips there behind his wife's back. At some point, Bacon probably hooked up with a resident of the area who eventually took his life. And there's also the fact that blonde hairs were found on the sweater. You'd assume those hairs belonged to the killer, but the witness who saw the unidentified man sitting next to Bacon in his car said he had dark hair. I was unable to find any details about the woman that the witness at the gas station allegedly saw in Bacon's vehicle, so I'm not sure if she had blonde hair or not. So who could David Bacon's killer or killers have been? Well, one person I'm pretty sure wasn't involved was Howard Hughes. It sounds like the two men who frequented Bacon's apartment, Harry Frazee and Glenn Irwin Schaum, were cleared as suspects, so I think the killer was someone we don't even know about. What seems pretty clear, however, is that Bacon was murdered because he had some sort of secret life. He had his own coded diary, which contained contact info for his friends and acquaintances, but a lot of other information which was never deciphered. He was placing ads for a gardener and then renting out an apartment to them for reasons which didn't make much sense. And he was taking trips to Venice behind his wife's back and was undoubtedly keeping secrets from her. So was Bacon killed because he got himself involved in a homosexual affair? Was a woman involved in his murder? I have a feeling that the answers to those questions lie in the sections of that diary which were never decoded, but who knows where that diary is today. Even if cipher experts took a crack at the diary, so much time has passed that I'm not sure they'd uncover any useful clues. While there is a lot of misinformation and fabricated stories floating around about this case, this is still one of Hollywood's most intriguing and bizarre unsolved mysteries. Since it is now over 73 years old, the odds of this case being solved are pretty minuscule, but if by chance you do happen to have any hard, verifiable information about the murder of David Bacon, and your name is not Darwin Porter, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own personal theory about this story, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. So thank you to everyone who voted on our one-year anniversary poll and for selecting David Bacon, as this was a pretty fascinating mystery to explore, and I'm glad I got to get a version of this story out there that is not littered with bullshit. I also want to send out a big thank you to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and of course a major shout-out to Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website. So if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. But most importantly, I cannot begin to express my thanks and appreciation for all of you folks, by awesome listeners who have made this an amazing first year for The Trail Went Cold. The support and positive feedback I have received for this podcast have just been phenomenal, and it is a pleasure to interact with you guys and discuss the cases I've chronicled. We would have never achieved this level of popularity without you, and I know that we're still just getting started, and this podcast is going to attain even greater heights. So once again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. So I want you to all have a good week, and join us next Wednesday for a brand new minisode as we begin an awesome second year for The Trail Went Cold. I shall now end things with some closing words from David Bacon, the Masked Marvel himself.
I was afraid you'd already gone.
I thought you might want this for a souvenir.
Thanks. Goodbye, Bob. And good luck to the Masked Marvel on his next adventure.
Thanks. Goodbye, Alice.
We'll be right back.